So the recording is on, and we'll get started. Okay, so last week we saw at the outset of our discussion together this interesting historical document. At least I found it to be an interesting historical document. It's a synagogue ledger book. Synagogue ledger book containing a diagram of the shul. It's a shul in, I'm not even going to try to pronounce that name, but a shul somewhere in Slovakia. And if you look closely, as we saw last time, you can see the names. You can see very faintly the names scribbled in. If you look at the gray arrow in the top left, it's pointing to a collection of these diagonal lines. They're actually the names of people. And that's where they sat. This is a seating chart for the synagogue, and it shows us that already in the early 1800s, and much earlier than that, people cared about their seats, and people cared about where they got to sit and what their seat was, and that was how we introduced this topic. And last week we spoke about the halachot of this topic, and when I say this topic, I mean the imperative to designate a place to pray. That's in Hebrew what we call makom kavua, the imperative to designate a specific place to pray. Now, last week we spoke about the halachot of this, we spoke about whether it's a mitzvah or just a good idea, but we spoke about this imperative, we spoke about the halachot, where it applies, to whom it applies, what to do if somebody is sitting in your seat. To recap very briefly, for those who were not here last week, essentially all you need to know for this shiur is that there is a halachic imperative called makom kavua, which dictates that one should set aside a specific seat or a place to pray. The Gemara praises such a practice. It's codified as halacha in the Shulchan Aruch. And so today we're not going to discuss the halacha, that's what we did last week, although our discussion will have halachic elements to it, but we're going to actually focus on the history of makom kavua. What I mean by the history of makom kavua is that this halacha, to have a designated place for prayer, has come up in very colorful, very interesting ways over the course of Jewish history, in ways that can teach us about things, everything from the Jewish communities of Europe to how to live a meaningful life. It can teach us about halacha, and it can also help us understand some of the major personalities in rabbinic history who actually engaged with the topic of makom kavua, not just halachically in their writings, but in their own lives. And we'll see what we mean by that. And so today we're going to discuss, not every halacha has such a rich history, many do, but makom kavua actually, from what I found, is one of the more fascinating topics, not just in halacha, but also in history. And this is tefillah, the past, the practical, and the profound. And so we discuss part of it as the past. And so today we'll start our discussion, I guess our second part of our discussion. The first is in this 19th century synagogue ledger book, which is it's part of a collection in Switzerland called the Braginsky Collection. I got this photo from their website. But we'll start our discussion in the 18th century with a specific incident that occurred involving Rabbi Eliyahu of Vilna, otherwise known as Vilna Gaon, exactly. So if you turn your source sheets to page number 2, we do need to learn a couple of background sources to understand this anecdote involving the Vilna Gaon. And we'll start in Bereishit, in the story of Yosef and the brothers. Yosef is, at this point in the story, a high-ranking Egyptian official. He discloses his identity to the brothers, and he tells them, after that whole encounter where he says, "I'm Yosef," and they're shocked. And he says, at the end of this, he tells them to go back to Canaan and to bring back Yaakov, and you'll all come and live with me in Egypt. That's what the Torah says. And as they set back on this journey to Canaan to bring back the family, to bring back Yaakov, the Torah tells us, "Vayasu chein b'nei Yisrael." They did so. They went back. "Vayitain lahem Yosef agalot al pi paro." Faro vayitain lahem tzeda ladarach. Yosef gave them wagons. Paro gave Yosef wagons to give them, and he gave them provisions for the journey. That's what the Torah tells us. Now, at first glance, this is rather expected. They need stuff to make the journey back and forth. They need wagons, and they need provisions. And the pshat is that Yosef sent them wagons so that they would have what to transport their family back to Egypt with, and what to transport themselves to Canaan to bring their family back to Egypt with. However, However, Rashi writes that before Yosef was kidnapped, if you look at Rashi on this pasuk in source number 2, Rashi writes that before Yosef was kidnapped, Yosef and his father would study Torah together. It's interesting, right? But what specifically would they study? They would study the laws of Egla Arufa. What's an Egla Arufa? Does anybody know? Yeah?
Yeah, so the heifer that's attacked, when a person is found murdered between two cities, so the Egla Arufa, that Egla is the heifer that's neck is axed.
Yeah. Exactly, exactly. Egla Arufa literally means axed or decapitated calf. Shoftim, the Parsha, the Torah in Parsha Shoftim teaches us that if a body is found between two cities and it's not known who murdered it, so what do? You measure the distance to the closest city, and the sages of that city have to decapitate a calf. That's the halacha. That's what they do. That's what they do to atone for and memorialize this person who died that we don't know who they were or where they were from. So Yosef and Yaakov were learning the details of this halacha. That was the Torah that they were learning before Yosef was kidnapped. And Rashi writes, in sending back wagons, Siman Masar Lahem, Yosef was sending back to Yaakov a symbol, B'masha haya osik kishepirish mimenu b'parshat Egla Arufa, as evidence that it was Yosef who was actually sending back for Yaakov and not some sort of imposter, because again, after all, Yaakov has not seen Yosef for many, many years. So it's a little hard to believe that all of a sudden, not only is your long-lost son still alive, but he's an Egyptian high-ranking official. So he sent back wagons, not just because they needed provisions and wagons for the journey, but agalot has the same root word as the word egla, from Egla Arufa. And so Yosef sent back agalot, wagons, as a symbol to Yaakov. It's really me. In fact, I'm going to send you something that's going to indicate, it's going to testify to the Torah that we learned together while we were still living together before I was kidnapped. And that will prove that it's actually going to be me. He was sending back wagons to demonstrate to his father that he was... that he was really who he is. Exactly. Exactly.
But do they speak in code? Like Yaakov understood the message?
So the Rashi doesn't tell us what happened when Yaakov received these agalot, but presumably he understood the message. But the question is, and there are a lot of interesting questions you can ask about this, the question is, what does this have to do with our topic? We're talking about Makom Kavua. What does this have to do with Makom Kavua? So maybe you'd think, if you're davening on a wagon, is that considered to be a Makom Kavua? That's not what we're going to talk about. It's not what we're going to talk about. It actually comes up in a fascinating piece from the Darchei Musar. The Darchei Musar is a sefer by Rabbi Yaakov Naiman. Rabbi Yaakov Naiman was a Rosh Yeshiva in Lida. He was a Talmud of the Chafetz Chaim. He came to Israel in 1935. He passed away in 1983. I believe he lived in Petach Tikva. His yard site is actually Aleph Elul, which is interesting. And he writes in his Sefer Darchei Musar, Rabbi Yaakov Naiman, on Parshat Vayigash, he quotes this Parsha of this explanation of Rashi, that he sent back wagons to subtly tell Yaakov that it was actually him. And he asks an interesting question, which is a fair question. Al shuma masar Yosef siman zeh b'mal lamad kishepiresh. Why did Yosef specifically choose this to convey as a symbol of his identity? V'lo hizkir simanim achirim lehochich Yaakov. Why didn't he give him some other symbol? I don't know. He could have, there are a lot of things. He could have sent back one of his kids that looked like him, and maybe that would have proven that he could have sent back a lock of his hair. I don't know, but there were other things presumably that he could have sent back to convince that Yaakov that he was himself. Rabbi Naiman asks, why did he specifically choose to send wagons? Why did he specifically choose to send a sign of what he was learning prior?
Even though he was in Egypt, that he had been learning, and that aspect of who he was,
Ah, so very good. So let's get to the end of the Darche Musar. It says something very similar, if not identical, to that. So he says, but does the question make sense? The question makes everybody gets the question. The question is, why did he choose to specifically use the wagons as a symbol and symbolize what he was learning? So he says, we're going to illustrate the answer to this question by relating a story from the Vilna Gaon. He says, Nifrash al pi maaseh sheya b'Vilna bizman hagur. Specific story that happened in the times of the Vilna Gaon in Vilna. It's a tragic story, but this is what happened. Be'isha aguna she'azva ba'ala achar nisueh. A certain woman got married. This man and woman got married, and the husband absconded, and he left. And he left her in aguna, meaning he did not give her a divorce before he left, and she was now unable to remarry another man as a result of this, because of the fact that he ran away. V'ne'ala mibeito, and he disappeared. What happened? U'le'achar shanim rabot ba'adam ve'amar she'ha ha'ba'al shene'alam, she'hu ha'ba'al shene'alam. After many years, this a certain fellow appeared in the city, and he said, "I'm that husband who ran away. I'm the husband who ran away, and I'm back. And not only am I back, v'natan simanim berurim heichan hayita hachatuna. And as proof that he was the actual husband, he related where the wedding was, because to prove that he was actually there. And not only that, umahaya, and what the wedding looked like, what was at this wedding. He described the wedding to prove that he was the actual husband who had run away all these years earlier." Va'amru zela hagra. And apparently they took this information to the Gra, and they said, do we believe this guy that he's actually the real husband? Do we believe this guy? He came back, he said he's the husband, and he gave proofs to this. He told us about where the wedding was and what the wedding looked like. Do we believe him that he's actually the husband? So the Vilna Gaon had an interesting idea. The Vilna Gaon said, Amar lehem sheba shabbat yivu'uhu lebeit ha-knesset. He said, bring this guy to shul on Shabbos. V'sham yom rulo l'shevet b'makom sh'yashav pa'am. And tell him to sit in his old seat. And if he knows where he sat, then you can assume it's a smart question. If this is really the guy, then he'll go to it. You tell him to sit in his old seat. If he's the guy, he should know where he sat. So he told him, he devised this idea, the Vilna Gaon. And so what ended up happening? V'asu kidvarav, and they did what he said. V'lo yada ha'ish. And he did not know where he had previously sat. V'noda ki ben Belial hu sharatza l'ramot l'shaker. And it turns out that this fellow was a liar who was coming to trick and to lie. Well, what was his motive in coming to pretend to be the husband of? So I don't know. There are a couple of possible options. Maybe he wanted to marry this woman. Maybe he felt bad for her and he wanted her to have a get. So he thought maybe he'll pretend to not be the pretend to be the actual husband. But in any case, it became clear. What? Yeah, but in any case, it became clear that maybe he wanted to get money. I don't know what money he'd be eligible for. Oh, interesting. Interesting. Okay, maybe. But in any case, he was not able to. It was proven that because he didn't know where he sat, it became clear that he was not actually the husband. And the Gra said, "How do you know that?" What did the Gra say? Amar Hagra. All the other proofs that this fellow gave were not actually valid proofs. Why? Because maybe one time he met this real husband, and the husband told him about the wedding, and so he knew all the details about the wedding. But when it comes to a holy matter, like your makom kavua in the synagogue, your designated seat, he didn't think that this was something that needed to be clarified with the husband. Because this fellow who was clearly wicked, because of his wickedness, would not have thought that something in the realm of Torah would need to also be ascertained. And so the Vilna Gaon knew that you can determine whether this fellow is legitimate, because if he's really a tricker, then he wouldn't have thought to ask about the actual holy matters, because He's not holy enough to be thinking of such things in the first place. That's what the Vilna Gaon said. And with this, the Darchei Musar uses to answer our question. He says, "V'zeh sheshalach Yosef," on the top of page 3, "L'Yaakov Siman Muvhak," and that which Yaakov sent to Yosef, a Siman, to demonstrate that he was Yosef, ki Yosef hu v'lo Ramai, and not some sort of trickster, ki misha Ramai lo haya notein da'ato levarer al Talmudo. Because someone who is a trickster would not have thought to inquire as to the Torah that was being learned between the two of them. Because that's not how a wicked person thinks. People who are righteous might think to ask about the Torah, but people who are righteous are also not going to trick somebody into thinking that they're really the son. So, heichan lamadu ve'eze inyan ve'yoter mizeh ratza Yosef, and more than this, as I think, sort of like what Kinaret was saying, l'harot l'Yaakov, Yosef wanted to show Yaakov, shekol hashanim adayin hu betzidko, that he remained righteous. That he remained righteous, because he remembered his learning enough to demonstrate that he had remembered it, and so he used it as a symbol of the ilu haya rasha. And if he was not still righteous, lo hayita da'ato al simanim elu, then he wouldn't have thought about these things to send them as a symbol.
You know, there's a very good French movie about the husband coming back. This would be the Jewish version. This would be the Jewish version.
Interesting. So, there's a message here, I think. It's an interesting story, no? It's a fascinating story, but there's a message here. And Rabbi Yonasan Geffen, I think in an article from H.com, says it well. He writes, "We learn from this explanation that things that occupy a person's thoughts and make up his speech give a very strong indication of one's spiritual standing. An example of a person whose level was indicated by what he spoke about was the great Chavetz Chaim. It is said that he was a very talkative person. What did he talk about? Torah and matters pertaining to the welfare of the Jewish people." By the way, this rumor apparently that the Chavetz Chaim was very talkative. Apparently he specifically was very talkative because he wrote the Sefer on Lashon Hara and evil speech. So he wanted to be talkative to show people that you don't have to be a quiet person to avoid Lashon Hara. You can be a normal social human being and still observe the laws of Lashon Hara properly, and those things are not a contradiction. A lot of times people learn the laws of Lashon Hara and they think, I guess if I want to observe this, I have to go into a cave somewhere. But the truth is, the Chavetz Chaim wanted to demonstrate that those things can go hand in hand, that you can be a social person and you can still observe the laws of Lashon Hara. And so he made a point of being a very social person, but he spoke about things that were about Torah and the welfare of the Jewish people. And he says, "We learn from Joseph's signs that that which occupies a person's mind is a great indication of where he is holding. May we all merit to think and speak words of true spiritual depth." So, essentially, holy people are more likely to think holy things. Yosef sent wagons to demonstrate that he was still thinking about holy things. And conversely, the Vilna Gaon used the same concept to test the alleged husband. He did the opposite thing. He used the holy matter of Makom Kavua to demonstrate that the fellow was not holy. But in any case, it's interesting how Makom Kavua can come up in such a role. And that was really the turning point of this whole saga with this Aguna, this poor Aguna, and the liar who came and testified that he was the husband.
What's interesting is that it's so much a part of a person, the Makom Kavua, but it's not something you would actually talk about.
Right. So his that was his point is that people who are thinking about holy things that might come to mind is something they should ask about. But people who are not thinking holy things would never think to ask about it.
But someone might talk about this.
One example of one time Makom Kavua came up in history, that was in the 18th century. But moving on in time, we actually arrive at the 19th century, and very interesting, perhaps somewhat of a tragic story here as well. It's a story told by Rabbi Herschel Schechter, one of the Rosh Yeshiva at YU, in his book Nefesh Harav on the halachic positions and more of Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik. And in the Nefesh Harav, he quotes from Rav Soloveitchik that one time Rav Soloveitchik told him and the other students the following story about the Malbim. Who is the Malbim? His mother didn't call him Malbim. His name was Rabbi Meir Leibush of Ukraine. He was a Ukrainian rabbi who passed away in 1879. And he is very famous for his commentary on Tanakh. He is probably most famous for his commentary on Tanakh. He also has written some halachic works, such as the Artzot HaChaim. They're not as well known as his works on Tanakh. And in fact, the Rav Soloveitchik told over the story, this actually, at least according to the Malbim, there was a reason for that. And it's this story. Okay. Kishalamadu Orachaim Hilchot Tzitzit by Yeshiva. When we learned Hilchos Tzitzis, the halachot of Tzitzis in Yeshiva, Hishtamashnu b'sefer Artzot HaChaim, which is one of the Malbim's halachasvarim. Sifer Lanu Rabbeinu, Rabbi Soloveitchik told us, She'et ha-sefer ahu chiber ha-gaon ha-malbim k'shahayat sa'ir liyamim. This sefer of the Malbim was written when he was very young. The Malbim wrote the Artzot HaChaim when he was young. V'nasa lepresburg al Shabbat lekabel haskama me'et ha-chatem sofer al sifro. And so he went to the city of Pressburg for Shabbos to get a haskama, to receive an approbation from the Chasam Sofer for his work, meaning the Chasam Sofer would sign off that this is good, it's halachically sound, it's valid, and it has my approval. And he went to travel to the Chasam Sofer to get an approbation for his work. This is very common. This is still happens nowadays where people travel to get rabbinic approbations, and this is what the Malbim did. In any case, the Rav said, V'sochecho yachad kol ha-shabbat b'divrei Torah. The Chasam Sofer and the Malbim sat together all Shabbos conversing in words of Torah. The acharei se'udash lishit, but after the third Shabbos meal, after Shalashuddis, kishechazu shnehem, when the two of them, the Chasam Sofer and the Malbim, the Beit HaKnesset, the Hitpalel Marif, after when Shabbos was winding down, what happened? They got up from Shalashuddis and they went back to the synagogue to David Marif. Haya afel v'kashel yirot. It was dark. They didn't have this the elaborate lighting fixtures that we have nowadays, and it was dark and it was difficult to see. And what happened? Va'al pi ta'ut yashav hamalbim al kiso shel ha-chasam sofer. The Malbim accidentally sat in the makom, in the seat of the Chasam Sofer. The Chasam Sofer in his shul, this was his shul, he had a designated place for prayer, and the Malbim accidentally sat in his seat. Why did the Malbim make this mistake? So, shekol ha-shabbat haya yoshev beit ha-knesset ha-sabuch etzlo. Because all Shabbos he was sitting in the seat next to the Chasam Sofer. And so he made a mistake and he sat one seat over by accident. Happened to be that was actually the Chasam Sofer's seat. What happened? V'tikiv shehekir b'davar echa mi-ba'alei ha-bayit. As soon as one of the congregants noticed that the Malbim was sitting in the Chasam Sofer's seat, he'ir lanu l'harav hatzi'ir al kach. He told the young rabbi, the Malbim, that he was sitting in the Chasam Sofer's seat, but what happened? The Malbim haya, patrecht in learning, he was immersed in his studies, he was learning, patrecht in learning, he was learning Torah, and he was so immersed in his Torah studies that what happened? Lo tafas betchila shahala haya medaber elav. He didn't notice that someone was talking to him, telling him that he was sitting in the seat of the Chasam Sofer. What happened? Chasam Sofer came in. Uchsheraa Chasam Sofer atanase amar leoto ha-baal ha-bayit. When he saw that the Baal HaBayit was trying to tell the Malbim that he was sitting in the Chasam Sofer seat, and the Malbim was too busy learning and too immersed in his studies to notice, he told the Baal HaBayit, "Sheyaniach lo lahala sheishar shama." He told him to leave him be, let him sit in the seat, it's okay, don't worry about it. He was a Baal Midot the Chasam Sofer, and he said, "It's fine, it's fine." Virat az hikir hamalbim bedavar. But this conversation between the Chasam Sofer and this layperson awakened the Malbim from his Torah thoughts. She'al pitaut haya yoshev al kiso shel harav. And he realized that he had mistakenly sat in the Chasam Sofer's seat, in the Chasam Sofer's makom. This all happened in the 19th century in Pressburg. Va'az v'ha'ala me'az v'ha'ala haya ikr kolachidu shelo b'tanach v'lo b'ha'alacha. And this is fascinating, and it's remarkable, and it's a little bit difficult to understand, to be totally honest. From that point on, the koach hachiddush, the innovative power, the creative potential of the Malbim, rested in Tanakh, and not in the world of halacha. Why, as a result of mistakenly sitting in the seat of the Chasam Sofer, did the Malbim lose his chelek in halacha, and have only a chelek in Tanakh? So the Malbim himself, the Hirgish Hamalbim Ba'atzmo, Shahaya Zebib Ne Shekilat Chacham Afilu, that the prayer of a righteous person, even if it's al tanai, even if it's conditional, mit kayemet, it will still be valid. Okay, well, did the Chasam Sofer say anything? Did he utter a curse? So actually, the Malbim felt that the Chasam Sofer uttered a curse. Ke'ilu l'shono shel Chasam Sofer. When the Chasam Sofer said to that Baal HaBayit, Shayishaer Shama, that you should leave him be, even though the Chasam Sofer literally meant you should leave him be sitting in my seat, Hayamusebet al dargat halimut shalom. No, he thought the Chasam Sofer meant you should leave him be, meaning he should stay where he is in his level of learning. He had come all the way to Pressburg to receive a haskama for his sefer of halacha, of the Artzos HaChaim, and he felt that when the Chasam Sofer said, Sheyisha'er Shama, that he should stay there, even though the Chasam Sofer didn't mean it, the Malbim apparently felt that for some reason, that this was a latent reference to, or some sort of existential reference to the level of his learning in halacha, and the very halacha that he had come to receive an approbation for. And as a result of that, shelo ya'aleh ha'alah b'halacha, that he should no longer ascend in matters of halacha. That is what the Malbim felt. And not only that, the Nefesh HaRav continues, it's not on the source sheet, that every Shabbos, the Malbim would seclude himself after this in a room, and he would come out weeping because he was mourning over his lost potential as a result of mourning over his lost potential as a result of this interaction where he had accidentally sat in the Chasam Sofer's seat. And even though the Chasam Sofer wasn't trying to curse him, the Malbim said that sometimes the words of a sage are so strong and so powerful that they can still have ramifications even beyond their intent. And so as a result, the Malbim, and if you ever wondered, oh, the Malbim was such a great Tanakh figure, but he wasn't a great halachist. Well, the Malbim apparently told this story, and he felt that this was the reason why. He felt that he lost after this his koach hachiddush in halacha. He lost his creative potential in halachic matters, and as a result was relegated only to the realm of Tanakh. He could have in theory been a scholar in both Tanakh and in halacha, and he still was. We still learn the Artzos HaChaim. It still is a halacha sefer. The post can quote the Artzos HaChaim. But it's not like his commentary on Tanakh. He's much better known for his Tanakh chidushim than his halachic chidushim, and he felt that this was the reason why.
Did he publish his book?
He did. It's the Artzos HaChaim. Still, it's a sefer. It's a well regarded sefer. It's not. Yeah, so he didn't lose all of his halachic potential, but he didn't grow anymore. He was, as a young lad, well, he doesn't say how old he was still very erudite, but he didn't make it any further than that. And his erudition, as at 20 or 30 or whatever he was still enough for him to write a great sefer, but he felt he didn't rise anymore from that. Yeah.
Tremendous respect that he had, you know, and that he didn't want to sit in the Chatam Sofer's seat because, just out of plain respect, not because he was interfering in it, not for a halakhic reason, but just out of his respect.
Yeah, it could be. I'm not trying to say that Malcolm Kavua is specifically the reason that this all happened, but just that it comes up in history. It does come up. So this is another interesting case where we see Malcolm Kavua playing a role. The last case we'll look at.
Maybe he believed it so strongly.
We'll now move on to the 20th century, to the 1900s. This is an interesting halachic situation that arose in the city of Sambir. Sambir is a city in western Ukraine. At least nowadays it's in western Ukraine. And in order to understand what happened in this city, we first need to learn a Gemara and Bava Batra. So following Gemara and Bava Batra. Hahu Dizvan, and source number 5, Ara Amitzra Divei Neshei Ki Kapalgu Amar Luhu. Let's read
number 6.
This is number 5.
The Sambir is number
6. Right. Number, we're reading this as a prelude to the thing. Number 5. The Gemara Bava Batra. Ahu Dizvan Ara Amitzra Divei Neshei. This certain fellow, let's call him Reuven, bought property next to his father's property. So his father had a field and he bought the adjacent field. Ki ka palgu, when his father passed away and it came time to divide the estate, he said, Amar lahu puliguli amitzrai. He said, I want to take the part of the father's field that's directly next to my property, because then I'll have all my property in one place and I can combine them and make one bigger field. Amar Rabba, kigon ze kofin al midat sadom. In this case, we force the other brothers to give him this plot of land. Halachically speaking, he gets this plot of land. Now, even though, we're talking about here, just to rewind, a certain fellow, Reuven, bought the land next to his father's property. His father died, his father passed away, and they're dividing up the land, and Reuven wants the portion of the land that's next to his property. Can the other brothers say no? Can the other brothers say no? So Rabba says, no, they can't. They have to say yes. They have to let him have it. In this case, even though technically he has no more of a right to that specific parcel of land than they do, he has a legitimate reason for wanting it. It's because it's next to the field that he already owns, and they do not have a reason for wanting it. And so therefore, they can't arbitrarily say, just for the sake of, because they can, no, we want that piece of land too. In this case, we say, Kofin al midan sedom. We force the other brothers not to act in a way characteristic of the inhabitants of Sodom and arbitrarily claim something that another person wants just because they can, just to make it difficult. That's a wicked way to act. It's characteristic of the way people in the biblical city of Sodom used to act. And so in this case, the court can actually force the brothers to give the land. Is that clear? Yeah, can I get thumbs up if we understand? Okay.
That piece of land doesn't have anything that makes it more valuable than the other.
Right. Exactly. That was your question also? Yes, exactly. This is a principle that comes up throughout Shas. Kofin al midat sedom. When someone is makbid on something for no reason other than the fact that they have the right to be makbid, then where someone's particular about something just for the sake of being particular about it, and their being particular negatively impacts another person who has a real rational reason for that thing, then the court can force in certain cases that person to give up their claim. It comes up in many places in the Gemara, and this is going to be relevant in a tshuva that we're going to read that happened in the city of Sambir. City of Sambir, this is a tshuva written by the Avnei Chayfetz. The Avnei Chayfetz is Rabbi Aaron Levin, or Lewin, depends on how you read it. He wrote a sefer of tshuvos called the Avnei Chayfetz. He was also known as the Reisha Rav. Rabbi Aaron Levin was known as the Reisha Rav. And this is what he says. This is what happened in the city of Sambir. It's actually a fascinating halachic discussion. Here in Sambir, lo hayu hasafsalim bevet haKnesset hagadol metukanim. The benches in the synagogue, the pews, were not very nice. Actually, we'll read it in English for the sake of time and readability. The benches lacked proper form and appearance, and it was decided by the heads of the congregation to beautify the house of our Lord, to beautify the shul, and make new benches. That would be for glory and for splendor. In other words, the benches in the shul didn't look nice. And so the heads of the congregation decided that they were going to replace them with nicer benches. A normal, natural renovation for a synagogue to make. However, the seat that was next to the Aron Kodesh was where the rabbi sat, as in many synagogues, and it was very narrow. The seat that apparently was given to the rabbi was very narrow. It wasn't comfortable to sit in because it was so narrow. And so the heads of the congregation decided to widen it in such a way that it would take up the space of the seat next to it. And therefore it would be two seats they would make into one seat. And therefore the Rav would have more space to sit. And it would be nicer for the Rav. And then what would happen? The seat that was absorbed by the rabbi's seat, the person who was sitting there, this is all along the eastern wall of the Beit Knesset, of the eastern wall of the synagogue, the seat that was next to it, they would make a special seat for the rabbi, and it would also make the shul look nicer, because it would have a nice seat for the rabbi. And in order to ensure that there wouldn't be fewer seats available, because they did absorb one seat to make the rabbi's seat, they would add on to the other end of the bench another seat. And then what would happen? Consequently, each seat holder would just move one seat down. In other words, if the rabbi is sitting here, and there was another seat here, and this seat became the rabbi's seat, then the fellow who was originally sitting there would just move one down. And the person who was sitting there would move one down. And the person who was sitting all in there, and because they added a seat on the end, then everybody would have a place to sit. Okay? Makes sense. Each person would move one seat over. He says in the second page, each seat holder would take the place of the third, and the third would take the place of the fourth, and so on until the end when the last person would take the seat that was added on. But what happened? The person who held the third seat holder. So we have the rabbi's seat, we have the seat that was absorbed by the rabbi's seat, and then we have the third seat, which is the first seat that was not touched. So what happened? The fellow who occupied this seat, that was his makom kavua, came and said he doesn't want to abandon his seat. He says his seat wasn't subject to any renovations. It makes sense that this fellow who was sitting got absorbed she doesn't have a seat anymore, so he should go sit on the end. But why should he force everybody to move down because of this? And therefore he complained and he said, I'm not moving. I like my seat in the third row. I shouldn't have to move down to be fourth. The guy who's fourth shouldn't have to be fifth. Let the guy who is second go all the way to the end, and that will be his new seat. And the matter, the Reish Rav says, reached me to decide between them. Who is halachically right? So that's the question. They wanted to know. What do you think? Who thinks he has a valid claim? Anybody? Who thinks that everybody should move down? Well, no one can. Those are the only two options here. Someone's got to think something.
Well, everyone had their makom kavua.
Yes.
So they had that claim. The person whose seat was disturbed was the only one that would have to move. It seemed like if you talk about the majority versus a singular person, that you might have the maximum benefit versus one negative result.
Okay. Any other thoughts?
What does makom kavua mean? In other words, makom kavua is next to the rav, and everybody's next to that one. Uh-huh. So basically, they're not really moving.
Right, we're going to talk about that. Yeah?
Yeah,
yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, you remember the Magen Avraham. This is how we pass in the halacha. The Magen Avraham holds that makom kavua is anywhere within dalet amot of the makom kavua. So one seat over is still going to halachically be the makom kavua. Also, you can make the case that it's not defined by its location in space objectively. It's defined by its proximity to the seat of the rabbi, and you're still sitting the same number of seats away from the rabbi. So he has a couple of very interesting proofs. One proof he has is if the Levium forgot to sing the Shir Shel Yom of one day, what do they do the next day? So he thinks maybe you could draw a proof from there, but I want to read his Iker proof. He writes, "Ve'Iker Hadavar." She'eino danin alav yeshlo. She'anu danin alav yeshlomar. We'll suggest the following. He says, Kevan de kol chashivu tamakomot beta knesset besafsal mizrachi, hu yachas misparam, yichus misparam, el makom harosh, hayinu harav. That's what you were saying. Exactly. The whole point of wanting a seat specifically here is because you want to sit close to the Rav. You want to sit close to the Rav. Otherwise, it doesn't matter. Why is this bench any different than any of the other benches? And so he said it's clearly because people want to sit if you're sitting in the shul and the rabbi's sitting at your bench, then the closer you're sitting to the rabbi, the more important you are. At least that's what people will think. And so people want those seats because it lends them kavod or whatever it is. There's the drush of Rav Shapiro about the Mishnah in Avot, ha-kina v'ha-ta'ava v'ha-kavod notzina sa'adam min ha-olam, jealousy and tava and physical desires and kavod and desire for honor, motzina sa'adam min ha-olam. They remove a person from the world. So Rabbi Shapiro's vort was that, why is it listed in that order? Kina, tavod, taiva, kavod, motzina sa'adam min ha-olam. He says, because when you're a young kid, you have the kinna, you're jealous, you want the newest toy, you want the newest, some adults are like that also, but you want the newest toy, you're jealous, this person got a snack, they got the blueberry lollipop, I got the strawberry lollipop, whatever, you're jealous. Okay, and then as you become older, that becomes to be replaced, the bigger challenge is usually your physical desires in adolescence, and then as an adult, people really just want honor. They want the honor of other people. And then Motzina Sadamin Olam, and then you inevitably pass away. That's the last stage, is honor. And that was his drasha of why it says it in that order. But in any case, people want honor. And they get the honor by sitting closer, as close as possible to the rabbi of the shul. And so he says, V'zulat zayin shum k'pei d'bin ha-makomos. And aside from how close it is to the rabbi, there's no difference between any of the seats. And as a result of this renovation, the proximity, the number, how close he is in seat to the rabbi is not going to change. He's just as close as he was before, this fellow in the third seat. He's just moving down one because the seat that was originally his is not there anymore. But he's still the same. He's still number one next to the rabbi. He's still the first seat next to the rabbi. And so therefore he says, this fellow is not losing, he's not lacking anything by moving down a row. He just wants to stay in his seat for a not good enough reason. And for that reason, maybe we can apply this rule of Kofi no toa midat sedom, that he is arbitrarily holding up the process. And not only that, but he's going to make the second guy go all the way to the end because, for what? He's still sitting the same number of seats away from the Rav, and that's why this is so important in the first place, says the Reish Rav. And so for that reason, we can apply the rule of Kofi no tal midat sedom, and he has to move down. He does not get to say that the guy in the second seat has to go all the way to the end and he can keep his seat. He has to move down, and everybody has to move down. And he learns this out from a tshuva of the Maharik, Rabbi Cologne, who was one of the Ashkenazi German Rishonim. The Maharik writes that in a Beit HaKnesset, Shehayasham HaMinhag Limkor HaAliyot B'Shabbos, there was a certain shul that sold their aliyas on Shabbos, meaning if you wanted, if you were a man and you were getting an aliyah to the Torah, you would pay money for the honor of having an aliyah. And B'Shabbat Bereshit, this was their custom to do, they would sell the aliyos on Shabbos Bereshit. Tzorech Me'or Beit HaKnesset, they would do it to provide light. The money would be used to light up the shul, to provide light in the synagogue. V'hayasham kohen echad shelo ratza limchol al kvodo. And there was a certain Kohen there who did not wish to forego his honor of being called up first to the Torah. Sheikru'uhu Rishon v'gam lo ratza liknos. But he also said, I refuse to buy an aliyah. So what is he doing? He's holding them up. He's saying, I'm not going to let you call someone up instead of me. And he's the only Kohen there. And I'm also not going to pay for an aliyah. So what do they do? Im yachulin anshei hakal lekofo shirechi pavav beisak reses acher. Can they tell him, okay, fine, go daven in another shul, we don't want you here anymore. And he says, yes, that we can force the Kohen to leave, because Kofi knows all me, that's a dome. Obviously in a situation where the Kohen can't afford to donate for an aliyah, so that would be different. But in this case, there was no issue involved. And so they said, yeah, this Kohen is holding up the whole process just because he doesn't want to participate. It's a community need and he doesn't want to participate. So that's a Sodom, that's something that some people from Sodom would do. They would hold up the process because they would insert themselves and their big egos into it. And so that we're going to force, we can halachically abrogate the Kohen's claim because of that. And so therefore, he said, and this is how he concludes, I didn't post the end of the Teshuvah, but he concludes that as a result of this argument, Kofi no toa midat sedom, the fellow has to move down. He wrote back, that's what they decided in the shul in Sambir. The fellow moved down and he was fine. I have it on good authority that he was fine. He actually quotes at the end the tshuva from the Beis Yitzchak. If you thought this was a sticky situation, Beis Yitzchak, there was a shul in Europe that apparently had two separate Ezras Nashims. There was one level Ezras Nashim, and there was another level Ezras Nashim. That was how the synagogue worked. And they decided that they were doing renovations, or they were going to rearrange the shul in a way so that the lower level Ezras Nashim was no longer there. And they were going to build a higher Ezras Nashim on top of the second Ezras Nashim. And all the women from the first Ezras Nashim said, this is now the new lowest Ezras Nashim. We want all of our seats. And they said, what are you talking about? This is still the same Ezras Nashim as it always was. This Ezras Nashim didn't move places. So he uses that as a proof. And whatever it is, he says, Kofi, you know, I don't remember what the conclusion of that teshuva was, but it's in the Beis Yitzchak. I can find it if anybody wants it. Rabbi Yitzchak Shmelkis. And so, in any case, these are three cases where Makom Kavua has come up in history. And as you can see, they're not just halachically rich. Makom Kavua is not just a halachically rich construct. It's also historically fascinating. We can learn from Makom Kavua the importance of thinking Torah thoughts. We can learn from Makom Kavua the importance of Makom Kavua itself, and at least in the Malbim's own eyes, the reason for his disparity of prominence between Tanakh and Halacha. And we can use Makom Kavua as a springboard, I think, to explore the application of interesting halachic concepts, such as what to do when a shul is undergoing renovation. So I hope you learned something. Again, we have this email list. I would encourage anybody who plans on attending this year, even not every week, to join the email list and sign up. And Be'ezrat Hashem, we'll meet again on Monday, July 3rd. Have a great day.